Right. Well, I guess what we've seen is just about every presentation so far has included some sort of model, a spatial map, or some sort of, you know, projection of what's going to happen. So we're finding that probably at the most fundamental level, we understand a fair bit of ecology and one or two species here and there. But the questions that are being asked from the sort of ecological community with respect to climate change and biodiversity require us to either make predictions in the future, which we sort of are very reluctant to do, but at least projections, so that we start to apply all our understanding and come up with some scenarios of what we think might happen. So we've got a range of ways of doing this. One that I think is probably one of the most valuable is to get a group of people like we've got today together in a room and have a big think about things and throw out some way out there ideas of what's likely to happen. The other is that we can start applying the current climate projections to our understanding that we've developed in our current models. Now, we've got to also realise that our current models were developed for the current time, or probably 20 years ago when the data was last collected. So we find that we're starting to even push the understanding of our current models, but they might be some of the best tools we've got. So two examples today. One is the flames model, as I've got to present the flames model. That's a model I've developed with Gary Cook, which is looking at the dynamics of trees in the tropical savannas. So over the years, we've developed quite a complex process-based model, which we can start applying a range of different scenarios to and just see what it does. I think sometimes some of the most beneficial uses of the model is by the research team. It's the surprises they throw at you, or they'll start to allude to what processes might actually be really critical in future that we haven't thought about. And that often leads to where we need more monitoring or more data. One idea, there was a question before about what happens if fire regimes change. So this is basically just running the flames model with a typical stand of Eucalyptus miniata and Tetradonta from around Kakadu, and changing the fire regime. So we can see that if we have no fire, a fire every 3 years or a fire every 5 years, we actually end up with quite different stands of trees. And sometimes these aren't that easy just to sort of see by driving around, and we don't have many long-term studies that have gone for 100 years that we can start to see some of this variation. So we can start to ask questions, what if? What if fire regime starts changing? What might be the consequence for our tree stands? And generally, a whole suite of biodiversity relies on the stand of trees. The other area that I'm very interested in is what happens if our rainfall changes. Now, rainfall's probably the least certain of the climate change projections. It relies a lot on very localised information. There's probably more information on how much we might get, whether rainfall is going to decrease or increase. But there's very little about seasonality, so whether our wet season extends by a month, our dry season gets longer, all these things for Northern Australia, which are important. This analysis here basically takes 1,000 millimetres rainfall, typical of Sydney. And if we put that in the model, we find it's aseasonal rainfall, they get winter and summer rainfall. We end up with a tree stand of about 18 metres squared per hectare. So that's a good solid forest that you'd see around the Blue Mountains. But what happens is, as you start applying 1,000 millimetre rainfall events to the model that are very seasonal, such as sort of somewhere Catherine sort of region where we can find 1,000 millimetres but it's extremely seasonal, we find that if we only look at that data in the model, we find that the tree stand is about 9 metres squared per hectare, so half of what we got for Sydney. So 1,000 millimetres, but the seasonality can actually really change the stand. But the scary thing is how quickly the stand of trees responds from the aseasonal rainfall to a seasonal pattern. So we actually only need to have 10% change in seasonality, and we've already really reduced our stands of trees. So some of this understanding, I think, needs to be sort of built into what's going to happen. Because, you know, so a change in rainfall seasonality could really start to modify the ecosystem of a region. So if we consider, say, Brisbane, Brisbane sort of relies on the fact that it's got open woodlands to closed forest. But a change in seasonality, so if Brisbane starts to lose a bit more of its winter rainfall and starts to become a bit more like the areas north of it, we start to rapidly change Brisbane's tree structure into a more savanna. And as soon as we do that, we introduce more grasses into the system, and so the whole fire regime might change, a whole suite of cascading effects. So the other option is we can go to some different sorts of models. Now, these are generalised dissimilarity models by Simon Ferrier and his group at CSIRO in Canberra. These models have been used for a number of projects that we're working on for both the National Reserve System and for the Queensland Government to actually just start to provide some basis from which we can make ecological discussion. Now, what we've found is they're extremely powerful, but they're very difficult to actually communicate the results to people. So what I'm actually going to do is I'm actually going to read captions from figures, because I think they actually summarise and help understand what these are. So this is basically the expected compositional change calculated by the model for each 1 kilometre square cell for two future scenarios, medium emissions and high emissions, where the dark pink indicates the level of a high level of stress, and the dark green indicates low stress. So that we can see the only dark green we get is actually on the scale. So all of a sudden, I think the ecologists were a little blown away when these results first came out, because we sort of had to stand back and go, we're in for some potentially large changes. You know, we can see that a lot of Australia is purple to dark purple by the high emissions, which we've already said is most likely. And we also see, and you'll see in some other graphs, that northern Australia and central Australia tends to really start to be affected, possibly more than some of these other areas like Tasmania and some of the higher elevation areas. We can do this for a whole suite of species, so this is for plants. We can run the same thing for mammals, which I sort of instantly thought, oh, this is amazing. And unfortunately, in a lot of these projects, the modelling work comes out at the 23rd hour of the project, and the ecologists don't get a lot of time to digest the information and provide more ecological understanding into the reports. But the interesting thing here is that this is starting to show high stress in mammal populations in the very regions where we're now actually reporting mammal declines. The other thing is we can start looking at what Dick referred to as novel environments. So these are calculated by comparing a cell, a point in the landscape, with cells within a 50 kilometre radius and cells within the continent to determine the likelihood of a given location disappearing or a new environment appearing at that position. So what we find is that the high dissimilarity or the dark purple areas indicate that the current environment is likely to disappear. So what we find, this is high emissions for 2070. So we're starting to say the temperatures and changes are happening such that what we're used to now may not be present. That's not to say that things won't still be there and the biodiversity might still be coping, but we're starting to move into some environments that we haven't seen previously. The other thing we can do is we can look at buffering, which is the sort of ability of a landscape to provide suitable conditions within given radiuses. So this one is basically 100 kilometre radius around a pixel. So you can see that some of the elevated areas along the Queensland coast mean that you can find other suitable habitats within the 100 kilometres. As soon as this report finally gets ticked off by the Department of Climate Change and federal government, it'll be available and a lot easier to understand. We can also start looking at these in far more regional understanding at different scales. So what we've got here is we've just grabbed one of the biodiversity hotspots and looked at what happens if we start looking in at different scales. And we can also look at other time spans. So now we're looking at 2030 under high emissions. So all of a sudden we're not that far away, and 2070 high emissions. And what you can see is you can start to see river lines and drainage lines acting as refuges. So you can see that different parts of the landscape start providing different stresses on population. So this is once again for plants only. And we can repeat the same process with the buffering analysis. So these are some of the tools that we're starting to use. Plus there's the whole suite of species distribution models. And I think it's going to be a combination of these tools and as well as when we start to get better projections of climate change and rainfall patterns. But it also highlights the fact that when we start looking at vast landscapes like Northern Australia, we realise that our data supply, data sources underlying a lot of these models are fairly scant. And so it's really highlighting, as some of our discussions have said, the need to be monitoring landscapes and further investigating different species, such as their thermal tolerances and things. Thanks.
Excellent. Thanks, Eric.